outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene.
Well, Kyle, happy Memorial Day.
And happy Memorial Day to you.
Which sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? I mean, Memorial Day is about all those who have served in war for the United States who have died, who passed on. Yeah. And I don't know that happy is the right word, but it is that day. We're sitting here talking about this. It's not going to air until about 10 days later because I am leaving town. Sarah and I are going to make a trip back to spend some time with our son again. So we're looking forward to that. We're not doing the RV this time, so little chance that we'll be thought of as drug traffickers, hopefully, in the area.
Oh, like, that's good.
Last year. Yeah, last year we were stopped for that and had our rented RV searched, but we're just taking Sarah's car this time and heading back with the dogs and go visit my – so this will be good. We need a good break. It's been a long spring.
Fill me in a little bit. I know that you were up visiting your dad last week, so kind of where is he at? I know there was some question marks there for a little bit.
Yeah, I get a lot of email, a lot of questions. So yeah, my dad is actually, the doctor told me last week, because he's rebounded really well. I mean, there was a point at which he didn't look like he'd make it through the night, and there was some concern through surgery. But as the doctor said, your dad is a very strong man, and he was cutting firewood a year ago, and he's going to recover from this, much to my dad's chagrin. My dad's kind of like, I'm ready to get on to the next chapter. But the doctor told me, I just said, you know, I know you don't know. He could have a heart attack tonight and be gone, but what's your best guess in terms of how we care for him and how we do whatever? And he said, you know what, there's no reason he can't live another 3 to 5 years. And that's where I would kind of think of it. He said, all his systems are strong. All that. So yeah. So the pressure's off there, at least in terms of, man, it looked like he's on death's door to no, it doesn't.
Mainly physical therapy now, or what's recovery looking like for him?
Yeah. And it's a painful, arduous trek through physical therapy for that. And, but yeah, he's got a few more days of that, maybe weeks, then he'll go, he won't be able to go home because he's 2 hours from medical care, practically an hour up, an hour back for an ambulance. So yeah, they'll be looking for other options for him. But yeah, all in all, he's physically doing well. And what have you been doing this Memorial weekend, Kyle?
It's actually been a really fun Memorial weekend. We had some great friends come down from Michigan and happened to meet up with them in Fort Collins. And man, just a really rich night of community. Cool. I mean, one of those just fun times where conversation just didn't stop. We were at three different restaurants, and the conversation didn't stop the entire time. In fact, we were getting to the point where we almost missed one of our reservations because we were deep in a conversation. Both sets were, and man, then we looked down at our watch and like, oh my gosh, like we better get going because we got another one to get to.
So when you plan an outing out with people, you generally book three restaurants reservations in advance. So you'll have time to. That's hilarious.
Well, yes and no. We started at a martini bar and then went to a really cool seafood house. And then after that, we went to this really fun speakeasy for dessert that's in Old Town. They were all within about three blocks of each other. So it wasn't like we were driving across the city or anything like that. But they wanted to get a flavor of Old Town Fort Collins. And so we took them to a few of our favorite spots. And then lots of yard work.
I met a new guy one time for lunch at a Denny's. We met early, about 10:30 or 11 or something, whatever. And we ended up having a late breakfast and then kept talking until 3, 4. The restaurant wasn't crowded, so the waitress kept saying, stay, lunch went. We ended up ordering dinner together. It's the first time I ever met him. And we connected at that level, have stayed connected. That was probably 30 years ago. We've stayed connected at that level and just have really celebrated a friendship. But that was the first time we had met. And we had mutual friends, but they'd been trying to get us together for a long time. So the other thing I've been thinking a lot about, it's in the news a lot this weekend. It really hurts my heart. I tell you, there's a visceral reaction in my gut to all the news that's been on about the Tulsa area, a Tulsa race massacre of 1921. And I think there's a connection there because I lived in the town for 4 years and it was not in the history books. It was wiped out from any kind of... Tulsa had no sense of identity with it. I mean, they buried it.
Yeah.
But there was the joke. When I was in college there, the joke was, you know, whites can't be north of 21st Street and black south of 21st Street at night. It just was too dangerous. And
Really?
And it was kind of a joke. But there was a seriousness to it. There was a real deep concern about the dangers that town. But I think what I've been thinking about, probably because not just how horrible that is. And those of you that haven't watched some stuff or listened to some stuff, you might really want to. You might really want to take this in, because this is better than, because we always think, oh, the race stuff ended with the Civil War, right? We already fixed that. And we had Reconstruction, which was a total failure in the South. And then in 1921, there's this successful Greenwood neighborhood of successful Black professionals that were built. It's called Black Wall Street. It was very successful, upper middle class people doing well. And then there was this mob of white people that stormed in on Memorial Day or Memorial Weekend in 1921 and killed maybe 75 to 300. They don't even know, because there's no records. Burned down business at 30 square blocks in that community, burned down their stuff, beat people. I think, 800 people were admitted to hospitals. Not one person ever arrested.
Jeez.
Not one person ever had their business replaced or money to help for the destruction. And I think where this hits me, I mean, I know things like that happen in the world. The default of humanity is to destroy each other. That's the default. When you find people who are kind and tender, that's the exception. And I know we want to believe it's the opposite. I know we're always shocked. Oh, I can't believe people would do that. Well, open your eyes, man. It's not most people. It's enough people. But then you've got a situation in Tulsa. This is what really hurts my heart. The situation in Tulsa is not just that it happened, but that the entire community, white community in Tulsa, buried it.
Intentionally just suppressed the entire thing, wiped it off the map.
To the point where it's never been taught in schools till now. Yeah. I lived in Tulsa for 4 years, never even heard about it. And when I started hearing about it, probably 5-6 years ago, I started hearing rumblings about it. And I'm going, what? How could that? I was there. And then you find out it's all true. And that there was this horrible massacre just because, jealousy, greed, got to keep the Black man down, whatever it was that drove that mob. And then it's all the other people around it who didn't seek justice against that mob for other people, for people. Yeah. Because, again, the problem with race where it's really broken is if someone's of a different race, they're less human. And that continues to play out today with some of the injustice that's going on in our culture and trying to fix. Interestingly enough, in the prayer group that I'm in that meets once in a while, praying for things in the world, somebody had posted, a friend from South Africa, about the banality of evil, which is just the commonplace, how evil becomes commonplace. And then even fairly good people go along with that as just because it's been reduced to nothing. And when I was reading the article about this, I'll just quote a little bit from a Jack Madden article on philosophybreak.com. It says, the banality of evil is the idea that evil does not have the Satan-like villainous appearance we might typically associate it with. Rather, evil is perpetuated when immoral principles become normalized over time by unthinking people. Hmm. Evil becomes commonplace. It becomes everyday. Ordinary people going about their everyday lives become complicit actors in systems that perpetuate evil. Hmm. And you look back over the course of history, I thought, as I was reading that, I thought of being in the Holocaust Museum in Israel. Mm-hmm. And there's pictures of, just pictures of those events. And you've got railroad carloads of Jewish people headed for ovens and concentration camps. And you've got soldiers in the foreground laughing and smoking and just completely desensitized to what's going on 5 feet from them. And those are the pictures, honestly, there are many others at the museum, but those were glaring to me. How can you be in that environment, have become so desensitized to evil that it's just normal? You normalize it. So I've been thinking a lot about that this weekend, because it just, I see it not only there, I've seen it in just normal situations of life. I've been in churches where the gossip mill is such that if you're on the wrong side of it, normal people will perpetuate evil rumor and lies against people they don't like. and feel completely justified, because he'll find a way to, these people deserve it, which I'm sure, and I don't know, because I wasn't in Tulsa in 1921, but I'm sure part of that, you know, bearing that whole thing is, well, they were uppity or whatever that mystique is in the South that says it's okay to do it, do this to them, because it doesn't matter. And so I don't know, how is your generation, Kyle? You guys are, these events are being talked about, this whole Black Lives Matter thing, and I know people are going to yell, it's a Marxist organization. Let's not even talk about it. Let's talk about the perpetuation of injustice against people of color, people of different races in America. And yet there are people to this day that kind of want to minimize the damage that's been done.
With any culture, with any generation, there's that tension between wanting to really honor and wanting to start moving in a more healthy direction where people genuinely do have equal access to whether it be resources or education, et cetera. But there's still that tension of the fear or the, well, what's going to happen to me, or how's life going to change if we go down this road too far? I think there's definitely still some of that. I think that's just the nature of humanity, no matter what your age is or what generation you come from. I remember when I first heard about the Tulsa massacres, it actually was when you were, there was some brief conversation about you possibly doing some work with a Tulsa massacre memorial when Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation came out. And I remember going and researching that and just being like, how on God's green earth have I never heard of this? Like, this is horrific. Like, and this happened on U.S. soil. And yet, like you said, we probably won't ever know all the details because it was so intentionally quelled by the people who perpetuated the violence that the history of it basically got wiped out. And yet I look at our culture right now and, man, I just see it, you know, like in the government, there's no accountability. They can do like almost whatever they want to do. And there's very little accountability for their behaviors or for their actions. I think there's starting to be some good movement when it comes to PD. I think the police department, I have lots of friends in the police department that serve our communities. And I think it's a very vital part of keeping our community safe and community service. But yeah, I think there also are a longstanding history of, well, this is the way that we've always done, that it's worth taking a look at and asking some common sense questions of saying, okay, well, do we continue to do that? Or what does that look like moving forward?
Yeah, I think two things here would help one understand a little bit the Black experience in America. If that can happen and nobody, there's no consequences for it in the majority community, and that's what they felt about, you know, actions on the part of police or others that have been racially motivated and unpunished and not dealt with. And again, you and I are both real advocates for police. I want good police officers. Most of them are great. Absolutely. But there's something about, I hear these stories and I'm unmoved by the pain of people on the other side of it. If it didn't happen to me or someone that looks like me, I don't feel the pain the same way as it happens to other humans. And I know that has changed for me. In just the journey. Is it completely changed? I doubt it. I understand about God transforming us is it's a long process, but I remember being a kid in school, and I can think back as I read this, because when I read stuff like this, I'm looking at not, ooh, look at these bad people out there. I think, where have I done this? Where have I normalized evil? Something that's wrong, and yet it became so, and we've done that as a society with, I think, sexuality in America. I mean, we have normalized some behaviors that are certainly hurtful and destructive to real relationships. And we've normalized just, if you desire it, it's good, go get it. You know, so there's that. I mean, there's that. I think about being a kid, and when you're in the right group of people and they start targeting the wrong group of people, and I'm using air quotes here. How easy it is to even mention the gossip mill. How easy is it to get caught up in the gossip and destruction of another person because they're not, you don't consider them part of your group. So they're target material. Then, and I, so I look back at that because I think there are two things that are really critical to perpetuate evil. One is a lack of caring, not having empathy for another human being, period. Sarah and I were walking in the park the other day with our dogs, and this lady came up to us, and she was a little bit unstable emotionally, say the least. And she came up, and she really jumped on me about men and what men do, and men just destroy because of men. I got put in jail. And I'm like, whoa. And Sarah's with me. We're like, excuse me, what's going on here? And she was trying to tell her story, trying to be seen. I feel compassion for her. She's on the street. She's homeless. And then all of a sudden I notice behind her, two policemen are walking up, and I'm like, okay, something else is going on here. And then they were kind of stood while we were engaging her and just kind of waited. And I didn't know where this was going. So I think this gentleman, I want to talk to you. And then she turned around. Oh, the mobile station called you. She's real upset about that. So I don't know what happened over there. Mm. And I still don't know what her situation is, but I'm not unmoved by it. They took it over from us. So Sarah and I moved on, and we talked about it for a while. You know, part of our humanity, I think, wants to not hold that much pain. And since we're not involved, you know, blame society, blame her, blame the homeless population, blame, blame, blame. Sarah and I didn't go there. We kind of just held that, you know. Mm. What do we do? That's a human being over there. Someone loves or loved completely on her own, maybe not having all the mental faculty she needs to negotiate life. And fallen through the cracks of a broken culture. And now law enforcement's involved. So I don't know what that means for her. But one of those things is empathy. I think sociopaths are the most evil people, whether they're in churches or in prisons for serial murders.
Yeah.
Because they have no concern about other people who they consider on the other side of things than they are. Whether it's a rumor mill, whether it's just lying about somebody, whether it's, I've got an agenda and I want to climb up the ladder and you're in my way, so I'm going to use your back to get there. And we know, I've talked on this podcast a number of times about places in my life where I feel like I have been the victim of other people's deceptions and lack of empathy and no remorse, even after the fact, even after you lay it down and say, listen, I'm not going to fight you. You have whatever you want. I'm going to go and do whatever. And whether that's a lawsuit, whether that's the pastoral experience I was a part of, I've had other relationships that have gone sideways like that. And part of me just says, what is it about me? And I've been through that a lot. What is it about me that says, betray me, screw me over, I'll feel better about life. You can feel rewarded about doing that. I don't know what it is about that, but that inability to feel someone else's pain. And I don't mean people you love and know and consider on your team. It's the people you don't consider on your team. How do you not? And I know this whole living love thing has created more empathy in my heart than I know what to do with, to be honest. And because I feel pain that I can't always resolve other than in prayer and giving things to God and saying, God, you got to be big enough here. So there's that. And I said there were two things. One is that inability to care about another human being, which I think Tulsa's guilty of that in 1921 for a whole race of people. And then the secondly is the arrogance of I'm always right. In all the situations I've been in where people have, whether it's like rumor minging or ripping you off in some way, or even just gaslighting you, which if everybody know what gaslighting is you set up a false narrative. And you may not even know it's false, but you've bought into a false narrative. And you, you nurture that among a certain group of people so that people who know that what you've incubated isn't true will always look like they're out of touch. They always look like no matter what they say, it'll be wrong because you've got a false narrative. And when somebody challenges it, it makes them evil. You put them in the evil construct. And abusers do it to their wives or husbands, abusive people. I think mostly women, to be honest, are really good at gaslighting their partner. Men are more physically abusive, but I know women
in America. This is more of an emotional, psychological abuse.
Yeah, and it probably isn't, in all cases, conscious.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that.
Sometimes it's a person's insecurity. It's their feeling like that they don't get what they deserve, so they need to tear down people around them who have more, whatever it is. But you create a false narrative, and then you live inside that false narrative, and you're threatened by anybody who won't join you in that narrative, so they become the enemy. And I, what I noticed about people like that, whether it was the elder group at the church I was at or some other situations I've been in, is that people in that never consider that they might be wrong.
Hmm.
They are right. They have the only perspective on this that matters. And I know for me, I get in situations now, I never assume I'm right. I'm willing to, I'll listen to anybody out. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt until I know they're telling me something that is factually untrue. Then I kind of go, okay, now we've got a problem because you're,
yeah.
I can't join you in a false narrative. I can care about the fact that you might believe something is true that isn't true. And how that will hurt you, how that will hurt other people. But I love on this journey that you, because I would, arrogance would be one of those things that probably would define me well into my 30s and probably early 40s. Because I thought I had everything nailed down theologically. I thought I could explain God in very clear terms. This part of the journey, last 25 years, has led me to a place of, I will say greater uncertainty, because I like being uncertain. I like being able to say, you know, I think God's saying this, and I think God's leading that. Let's see, because that keeps you open to new experience. And once you say, I've arrived, I've nailed this down, I'm right. Now, I get to destroy anybody in the way of my being right. And that's one of those things that just doesn't work against evil. You can't fight evil with evil. You can't fight lie with lie, even though politicians try all the time. and our media helps them do it on both sides of the aisle. But you can't, and anybody know, if you've been caught in a work environment where people have turned hostile towards you, or family environment, or church environment, and it's really predicated on a lot of disinformation, right? There's no defense. Even if you say, you know, that isn't true. Oh, well, you're just defensive because you're that way and you're that way. And I love the uncertainty in my heart that says I can get into something with you and I may not see it the way you see it, but I'm not 100% sure I'm right. So I'm willing to weigh it. Doesn't mean I believe everything that comes. So there's this comfortable uncertainty in my life, not uncertainty about who God is.
Yeah.
Not uncertainty about how he works in the world. Not uncertain about evil when I recognize it, to not be able to call it what it is and say, you know, that's evil, even though they think they're doing good. How many times did Jesus say, or at least intimate, those who persecute you will think they're doing God a favor?
Yeah.
That's true in my life. Everybody that's done the worst things to me that I can look back now after years and say, yeah, they were wrong. All were doing it with God's direction. And I was talking to someone recently, and they said, you know, God, and I was just challenging, just saying, are you sure that God told me to? And that was the cutoff. That's the conversation.
End of the conversation.
Ended. Yeah, because now we're not going to be talking about whether this is right or wrong. The question, the conversation has to go to whether you're hearing God or not. And that's not a conversation you get to have with people who are not empathetic and who are not open to being wrong. And I think that's why God speaks to us in a way that we're never certain.
Yeah.
We have impressions, we have nudges, we kind of think that's the road. It's always open to other people. Help us interpret that and go, you might be making a mistake. I've had wonderful brothers and sisters save me from some stupid activity because they dared to say, Wayne, are you sure?
Yeah.
And I go, I thought I was. But talk to me. What do you see? And then in talking with them, and then when I do that, I don't always take what other people say, but I always give it an incredible amount of weight. So if I'm ready to make a decision and you or someone comes along and says, Wayne, I'm not really sure about this. It doesn't mean, okay, I won't do it. It means I'm going to hold that for a number of days. I'm going to give that time so the Holy Spirit can show me someone might be giving me a really good caution that I'm missing.
Yeah.
But where people lose that faculty, where they are right and you are wrong, and they can't have a conversation that goes outside their narrative. I've got a close friend who got involved in a cultish thing and then went really into a dark side of theological thought. And always what surrounds the cultic kind of thing is you're not allowed to talk to anyone who doesn't agree with what you already know. Why? Because it's so pick and fragile. Lies are fragile. They have to be bolstered up. You got to find friends who will crawl into the lie with you. And you've got to, and it just, if we could cultivate, I think those two things, just, I'm not always certain. So I live more open-handedly in the world, which doesn't mean I'm a flake and get blown around by every opinion other people offer us. It just means I'm seeking to follow God, but I'm holding lightly my ability to discern accurately. So I can be wrong, and I don't, you know. And the other part, just keeping empathy for people who are even on the other side of decisions that you're making that may be difficult for other people to bear. If you have no empathy for those who are having to bear it, then you might wonder if you've not slipped into the banality of evil. It's just commonplace to do this.
I really feel like, as you were talking, I feel like that a lot of people, when they're in that space, they really can't face it, right? Because their identity in some form or fashion, a deep part of their identity is tied into that. And so if they actually look at that or that gets exposed or gets challenged, then they don't really know who they are. They're losing a framework for who they are. And I think part of your piece of piece in your ability to be able to be in that space where there's some uncertainty is because you started with, I am loved. I am loved by the Father, period.
That's good.
That's where you start. Like that's, you know, and that's still growing and you're still working that out in the day to day, but a large portion of who you are, that's where it starts. And so then if you start there, then it's a lot easier. So that's one thing that they teach in for like Clifton Strength Finders when they're doing coaching with people. Say it's a lot easier to talk about roadblocks when you're coming through the lens of strengths. If you're coming through the lens of love, then it's a lot easier to talk about things that you may or may not agree on or things in your life that might need to be changed or worldviews that you might have that might not align with who God is. Because you started with the concept of, I am loved, totally and completely, unconditionally loved, period.
It's true on the other side of this that people who are locked into this sense of security and always got to be right and God told me so are really dealing, like you said, with an innate internal insecurity. I didn't say eternal. I said internal.
internal
insecurity that they can't even contemplate I'm wrong because their life's barely, they can barely hold together the lie themselves.
Yes.
They don't even know it's a lie.
Yep.
But if what I have invested all my energy in proves not to be true, then a part of my soul dies.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't have the emotional capacity to step back until there's a sense of I'm loved and I'm okay where I'm at and God's bigger than whatever gets dismantled in my life. I think I enjoy it. Makes you really trying to live loved in a world makes you a target for
yeah.
broken people.
It does.
Right?
It does.
And I hate that. I read all this stuff in Psalms, which is a lot. We had a lot of fun with the Psalms lately because you read stuff in the Psalms that's just incredibly true. And then you read stuff in the Psalms like God talks about those or David prays, you know, those may those who deal treacherously be caught in their own traps and all that stuff. And I was saying to some friend today, I don't see where that happens really. Yeah. I mean, in any immediate sense of real time justice, you know, people, liars succeed. They succeed well in the world. They manipulate people. They often get their way. And I don't think the trap is, oh, their lie is going to be exposed. I think the trap is they have to live in their lie and the soul-crushing reality of that that may take years to manifest.
Mm.
I had this thought on the prodigal son today because I love that story. I've told it and he loves me.
Yeah,
it's a great story. But there's an element of that story I've never talked extensively about because it makes me feel a bit weird about God because I know God is the pursuer in my life. I know it's not me coming seeking after God. It's God who's made himself known to me. In this story, it's always bothered me a bit that the father just stays on the farm. The boy runs off. He's wasting money. He's falling into sin. Eventually, that sin leads him to bondage. And the father never goes out there to say, hey, son, come home. I love you. All's forgiven. You know, come ever. And I was thinking, Sarah and I actually were talking about on our walk this morning. And I said, you know what? I get it now. Because people who live inside a lie, the truth does not resonate with them.
Yeah.
So if the father's coming after the boy, the father's even further destroying the relationship.
How so?
Right? Because he's going to be in that boy's life say, hey, you're making a big mistake. Mm. Well, the kid already doesn't like the father.
Yeah.
So now he's going to be more defensive and more, my dad's just a nag. When you live inside lies, truth is a threat to you. So it's going to make you go deeper into lies. So what father's willing to do is, I'm going to let you run to the end of your lie.
Mm.
And that's maybe where the treacherous fall into their own treachery. You're going to run to the end of your lie. Now you're going to be you know, broke and in bondage and eating pig food. And now not because you care about truth, but because you can't stand your circumstances anymore, yeah, you will be more open to truth. And I just think, wow, because almost everybody I've tried to convince that they're wrong, it doesn't work. Nope. I'm not interested. Until they get to a place where they're calling me saying, Wayne, I think I made a mistake.
Yeah.
Talk to me. What's going on? And that's the door that opens. And some great, yeah, I've had some wonderful betrayals in my life. I've had some wonderful restorations in my life where people can go back and say, I really blew it. Like the young boy, I've sinned against heaven and earth. I've sinned against you, Father. And he comes home. Now, all good things can happen. That's just a great little, I was thinking that this morning. Okay, now I get it. Because every time I've stepped out of an environment that I felt was, and I've not used this term gaslighting a lot, I've not understood it till recently.
Yeah.
Where I've stepped out of a gaslighted situation, I was the one being gaslighted. And you finally, I mean, you feel like you're nuts for a while, because how can I be the only one who's not seeing? Because I'm open, yeah, enough that I couldn't be wrong. Then I'm going, how do I not see what everyone else is seeing? And then some things happen where you absolutely know the truth of it, that, yeah, there actually is a lie on which this is based.
Yeah.
And when you step out of that environment, what I've noticed is those people still come after you.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not there. If this was a contest for power, I'm not playing the, I walked out. Yeah, still, no, now we got to discredit you.
Correct.
Because why? Because of their guilt.
Yep.
Because of their sense of shame, and because they're living inside a lie, there's no relief for that shame except to blame someone else.
To manifest, to continue to fuel that lie, or to fuel the fire of, yeah, this is, you know, I have to maintain this narrative, or everything that I have just built and everything that I just tried to do is now all falling apart again.
Yeah. We're in graduation season, man. All the great things tell graduates, you know, you can live your dream if you just work hard enough, all that. There's a million broken hearts in Nashville that prove just because you want to sing and can sing that you can get a career in music. There's thousands and thousands of actors and actresses in LA that have the same reality. Yeah. I know lots of people had great aspirations to be president of the United States. And I hate it now when some celebrity to justify, if you work hard enough, you, yes, can have the dream of your heart. I go, no, that's not even true. So here's a principal that said to his class last week, successful people stomp on each other. And he actually got escorted off the high school because he made a statement like that and some others. He's a principal whose contract wasn't renewed because of some kind of infighting and political reality in the district. But he got up and I think gave probably the greatest bit of truth that we all need to know. Successful people will stomp on you. And James says that, right? He says, yeah, don't look at the poor are not your problem.
No.
It's always the wealthy. It's always the successful. Bill Gates, Zuckerberg, they're never happy with how much they have. No. They need more. And whatever they have to do to get more, they're going to get more.
Yeah.
And it's true of people in our lives. And I think it's helpful when you can sit down with somebody who's really suffering the 16th time of being brutalized by people around them. And they're thinking, what's wrong with me? Why does the universe function this way with me? Why does God not protect me? The reality is that's more the default than good people get rewarded. Honest people get rewarded. That's just not true in this broken world, which means, oh, let's all be liars then. To me, it's, my gosh, I want to live in that. That's what Jesus scripture talks so much about, being lovers of what's true.
Yeah.
Because that's where, what the life you and I talk about on the God journey, it's inside that. It's not inside my lies, the things I tell myself to give me false security, the cognitive dissonance, the justifications for things I want to do that the way I normalize evil in my life. That's not where transformation is. Transformation is the risk of looking full on in the truth as best we see it. None of us see it well, yeah, so we're going to get it in glimpses. And then this is what we talked about in Embracing His Glory last year, when Jesus pokes a hole in our pretensions. That's what he's talking about. Jesus shows us you've got a lie that's anchored in your heart. You have the choice then to let it go. And that, yes, may take 6 months to make that choice.
Oh, absolutely.
So I it's not easy. Or you have you get the spiritual duct tape and you duct tape it right over. So I don't want to see that. I like this lie. It comforts me. And then within a week, I can talk me out of it even being a lie. It's the truth.
Yeah.
It's the truth I have to live by.
There's also one thing that I also want to mention as we've been chatting as well. And this is something that especially working in the mental health, life coaching world, in the education world, any kind of like service industry. One of the things, and maybe you and I've talked about this a little bit before too, as well, is compassion fatigue. Have we talked about this at all?
I don't recall.
So compassion fatigue.
More avid podcast listeners will hear the answer to that question.
That's fair. That's true. There's some, I'm sure, that would be able to quote it back to us.
That was episode 763. Don't you guys remember that?
But compassion fatigue is when we're constantly faced and with challenges, pains of the world, trauma, and it's that heart reservoir to be able to care, to be able to hold that pain well, to be able to share that empathy with others, slowly that gets depleted. And they find it especially like in, you know, clergy, medical service, education, counselors, where they're faced with these daily life traumas that they're talking with people about every single day. And that reservoir to care, that reservoir to extend empathy to another human being, it slowly starts to get depleted. And eventually it completely runs out if you're not intentional to refill that space and to take a deep breath, to allow your heart to be healed, to offload some of those traumas. You know, like, for example, you were talking about the lady that you bumped into in the park, and yet how many people in the Los Angeles area have a full-on homeless filter now, to where they can walk down the street and pass 150, 200, 300, 1,000 people and not even know that they're there. And I know, I mean, when I was living in Los Angeles, I knew I could turn those blinders on. I could walk down the street and have no idea, like just keep on going. Like it's just a normal part of life. But if I actually care, it's going to cost too much. And I don't have the reserves to be able to care that much anymore, because I care here, I've cared here, and the world has just sucked me dry. And so I feel like that's just something too, with the 24-hour media, social media, and just the constant stuff that we're being faced with. Like what pains do I allow to impact me to hold versus what pain do I say, like, I appreciate that, but I can't do anything about it? Because I feel like that's one of the really negative impacts of the 24-hour news cycle. Is you're getting constantly bombarded by all these pains and traumas that people have been going through. And yet it's like, what do I do about that? How do I hold that? Like, how do I express empathy to that versus like, you know, I don't know. It's just interesting.
Which I think is why, I mean, it's one thing if it's your profession to care for people. I don't know how to answer that. In the world I live in, part of my heart says, I have enough reservoir to love who God wants me to love today. Mm. I do. And so I don't take on, I think if you take on empathy for the world as a principle, then I think compassion fatigue is a very real thing.
Yeah.
But like with this lady, we engaged her briefly. We tried to offer encouragement. Police took over. We walked away. But I think how I don't close my heart to that is we talked about it a little bit, yeah. Sarah and I, and we prayed for this woman and prayed that God, and we asked God, are we involved in any way?
Yeah.
And we didn't sense that we were. So I don't go away saying, oh my gosh, she talked to us in a park, so now we owe her something. Oswald Sanders, I think it was, said this amazing phrase, which I live by it all the time. It says, I am your servant, but you are not my master.
Mm.
And that's,
ooh,
that, to
I
me,
like
it's
that.
It's a great way to see the world, because I am your servant. I mean, Jesus called us to be servants, to live here, to serve, to be open to need, to engage people, but you're not my master. So how I serve you really has got to come out of this, how is Jesus leading me at the moment? Am I involved in this? If I am, I will be. I cannot meet every need in the world around me, even the needs I see every day.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to live in that by protecting me from seeing it so I don't have to feel it, then we're going to become unempathetic.
Yeah.
If we can hold it and just give it to Jesus in the next 30 seconds, it doesn't mean I have to hold it for a day, a week, a year. And when I get overwhelmed with that, I mentioned one day a number of years ago, it's on vacation, we got 3 emails in the morning from people who told me their kind of life story of abuse and horrible stories. Yeah. And at the third one, I was overcome by pain in the world. And so I just walked out into the woods and just said, God, how do you do it? I don't know how you do it. Yeah. I've seen 3 things today. You see billions of what's going on in the world and how humanity is inhumane to itself. How do you endure this? How do you endure the kids being abused today, the kids, the people who are being victims of war or poverty, or how do you hold all that in your heart? Somehow God does.
Yeah.
And still at the end of it all, God is the most joyful presence in the universe.
Yeah.
He doesn't ignore evil. He doesn't ignore hurt or pain. And yet Jesus can still say, I want my joy to be in you and your joy to be full. And that's part of the transformational journey that I'm on. How do I find my way into joy, even in the midst of suffering?
Yeah.
And to me, there's no way to do that philosophically.
No.
The only way to do that, to me, is by just an ear to, if I'm involved here, let me know. They don't know that I am. And institutional answers are not the best ones here. I had a conversation with the chief of police in the town and the homeless situation, just that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he says, the problem is this. We've got, I forget what he said, 180 homeless people in this town that we're in. He said, if we do anything more for them, he said, it'd be pretty easy for us to find a hotel, find something so that we could provide for these 180 people.
Yeah.
Particularly the ones that are emotionally broken. Mm-hmm. But he said, as soon as we do that, there's 38,000 coming over from Los Angeles County because no one else is doing it.
Yeah.
And that's where institutional fixes to me, just until everybody does it, these things can't be fixed institutionally. But individually, if I know of someone or am I connected to someone or I pass someone, and we pass homeless a lot where we walk. We live in California, and we don't stop and have that conversation with God every time we walk by one. But
yeah.
I always acknowledge it. I always acknowledge the person. I usually say hi, nod at them, something.
Yeah.
Let them know they're seen. But I don't, until I have clarity as to what to do, I don't feel the weight of I should do something. Now, the old Wayne felt that all the time, which is why I closed off everything.
Yeah.
But the living love, Dwayne says, the same God who loves me loves them. He has options. He has whatever. And I'm one little factor in all the resources God has to help that person. Mm. How he wants to is what I want to see.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.